We know in theory that earthquakes happen a lot, daily in some places. Recently, a rash of earthquakes have struck along the Pacific coast of the Americas, including a somewhat strong one in Argentina the day before. No deaths or damages were reported with those quakes, but with the earthquake that devastated Haiti last week, some people are wondering, is all this seismic activity normal? With me now here in Studio 3A is NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Welcome to Talk the Nation.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So let's start with the is it normal question. Is this seismic activity normal?
Yes, I would think the answer to that is yes. I went to the USGS website, the Geological Survey's website today, and I was just sort of perusing the list of earthquakes, and we've had six already today of magnitude 5 or above. There were 14 yesterday of magnitude 5 or above. This is, you have to ask, well, this seems like a lot of earthquakes, but over the course of a year, according to the USGS, there are 134 earthquakes between 6 and 6.9 magnitude. So that's, I mean, we're talking even larger than that. If you're looking at the 5 range, it's like 1,300 which a year, which is about 4 a day. So, you know, earthquakes happen. Earth is a very dynamic planet, and we sort of lose track of that. But actually, it does happen.
Well, it's interesting looking at that USGS chart because the numbers get smaller in a hurry. You know,
That's true.
The earthquakes in the fours are 13,000. Earthquakes in the fives, 1,300. Earthquakes in the sixes, 130. I mean, it's almost you drop a zero each time.
That's true.
Which also gets to the question of the Richter scale is not a steady incremental scale, it's an exponential scale. Can
That's
you
true.
Explain
yeah.
that a little bit?
Yeah, they basically, each point on the magnitude scale, they don't say Richter anymore, that's sort of a little outmoded. But
no, I'm sorry, the I'm magnitude, passe.
That's fine. But the scale still exists, but it's not really used anymore. But at any rate, it's true that each step up gives you a whole, each number may seem like a small number, but it actually represents a very large change. It is, as you say, an exponential scale. So by the time you're talking about earthquakes of 8 and above, which are truly massive earthquakes, they on average happen about once a year. Those are extremely rare. So,
which is 10 times stronger than a 7.
In terms of earth movement, yeah, that's true.
But earth movement is only part of it, which is
that's
also
true.
We're getting into the weeds a little bit here.
Yeah, but
as long as we're explaining.
You also have energy that's released, so that's not 10 times the energy. You actually get more energy released for each earthquake, which is why they're felt over much wider scales and so on. You can get a very large dramatic difference between the smallest earthquakes you can feel and the biggest ones. They can make even though the numbers on the magnitude scale are not that different, the way you feel them and the way they are felt globally can add up very rapidly.
And is there an earthquake season? Are there times a year when they happen more often?
Not to my knowledge. I've never heard that said before.
It just, following it, obviously, now in January because of the Haitian quake last week, you wonder, looking at annual numbers, whether those bunch around certain times a year. But if they did, it would be an easier thing to predict, and earthquakes are notoriously impossible to predict.
That's true, yeah. As far as I know, they are just sort of happening willy-nilly. And even, you know, one year to the other, you can even get some fairly dramatic differences. For example, let me pull out a couple more numbers here. For example, there were relatively few earthquakes of this size in 2009 compared to 2007. I mean, you do get year-to-year variety. But again, it's just because these things happen kind of unpredictably. Let's step back for a second and think about where earthquakes come from. You have the Earth's plates, these tectonic plates, shifting past one another. And what happens is they don't move smoothly, sort of over long periods of time. They rotate and they move past one another. But they stick together. There's like friction that holds them still. So basically, you have these two plates that are jammed together. And eventually, the stress builds up enough, and bing, they release that stress all at once, and that's an earthquake. So you have this kind of, you know, in the long term, you know that where the stresses are building up and how big an earthquake might be in a particular place, that's been fairly well established. But guessing when that rock is going to break and when that slip is going to happen is beyond the realm of science right now.
Let's take a call from Jose in Port Charlotte, Florida. Jose, welcome to Talk the Nation.
Yes, I just wanted to ask a question. When an earthquake happens, like a big one, say like the one in Haiti or elsewhere, are they related? Because usually, when one earthquake happens, then you get like other earthquakes in other regions. Even when the tsunami hit in the other part of the world, in Asia, in Indonesia, actually, there seem to have been like other earthquakes, even if they have been underwater or in the form of tsunamis or something like that. Are they all related? Does one tectonic plate affect one in another part of the world? And I'll take the answer offline.
Thanks, Jose.
The answer to that generally is if it's close by, the aftershocks, of course, are closely related to earthquakes and the original earthquake. Seismologists also say that over lengths of, 600 or 1,000 miles, you might have a relation between an earthquake and other earthquakes. But across the globe, the general answer is no, that apparently that's not the case. And although there are some scientists who are still teasing out that question and saying there is some possibility that a large earthquake one place can cause it elsewhere, because an earthquake greater than magnitude 6 is going to send its seismic waves all around the planet, and so that earthquake will jiggle the entire Earth in one place or another. Some scientists say, well, the jiggling from that is much smaller than the effect of the tides that are caused by the moon. So, hand waving argument is like, well, if it's even weaker than what the moon's tides are doing, then it seems highly unlikely that the earthquake will do it. However, it's a really interesting question. Scientists are digging into it. There's some intriguing suggestions that this might be the case. But as a general rule, once you realize, what we in the media do is once there's an earthquake like this, all of a sudden people are paying attention to all the earthquakes around the world. And so these earthquakes, we never report 5 to 6 magnitude earthquakes unless there's some dramatic reason to do it. But all of a sudden, we're paying attention. The earthquake happens, somebody gets, shaken up a little bit in Venezuela, and we put something on the air. So it's sort of...
Well, it also makes you wonder if the opposite might also be true for different places along the same fault, that a quake one place might relieve the pressure somewhere else on the fault and actually make it less likely to have an earthquake there.
That is exactly right. You get both building up of pressure in some places and you get relieving pressure in others. So it's quite a skill to try to sort out how that stress changes after an earthquake. And scientists have been doing that right now for the Haiti quake. I've seen actually a map that shows where stress is building up and where stress is diminished. But it's still, again, that's a much more of a local phenomenon than a phenomenon across large areas of land.
Now, we heard with the Haiti quake that it was a relatively shallow quake. What does that mean?
What that means is the seismic waves don't have to travel so far in order to do damage. And it was not only shallow, but it was very close to Port-au-Prince. So the quake was it started about 6 miles underground, and it was only about 10 miles from Port-au-Prince. So you end up in a circumstance where that incredible amount of energy that's being released doesn't have a chance to dissipate very much before it hits Port-au-Prince. And that's one reason we saw so much devastation there.
Let's take a call from Ted in Portland, Oregon. Ted, welcome to Talk the Nation.
Hi. I appreciate comment on the Cascadia Fault off the coast off the west coast from Vancouver, British Columbia, on down to Northern California. It goes every 300 to 500 years at magnitude 9, and the last time was January 26th of 1700, which we know, although that was long before white people invaded this part of the world, we know that because of Japanese newspapers, there was a tsunami that hit Japan afterwards. And so we're in the zone on that, and we've been told that a magnitude 9 would shake Portland for 8 minutes. We have 1,200 masonry buildings here, all of which would be expected to come down. And today's Oregonian, our newspaper, says, are we ready? Probably not. And I'll take any comment offline. Thank you.
Thanks, Ted.
Yeah, that does describe a well-known phenomenon, which is also true in Haiti as well, which is that the longer there has been stress building up on a fault, the greater the potential is for a very large earthquake. And, for example, in Haiti, this earthquake, this fault zone hadn't ruptured for a couple of hundred years. And so scientists had actually projected before this earthquake occurred that an earthquake of magnitude up to 7.2 could, in fact, occur on this. And if that stress was relieved all at once, and we saw, well, most of it was. There's another fault that runs just to the north of Haiti off the ocean, then it goes across the island of Hispaniola, which is the island that Haiti is on, and that hasn't ruptured for 800 years, and that could have a very substantial earthquake on it as well. And obviously this is a general phenomenon that the longer it's been between great earthquakes, the greater potential you have for another great earthquake. It also means the uncertainty about, if it's been 800 years, it could be another 100 years, or it could be another 200 years, or it could be, 10 years. You don't really know. So those are very real seismic hazards, and the safety people in the Northwest are right to focus on those and say, this is a potential. We have to think about how, you know, that we have to ask ourselves, are the buildings built to withstand the greatest possible earthquake here? And if not, what can we do about it?
You know, I lived in San Francisco for 10 years, and even though they obviously had a big quake there in 89, there was constant talk about, you know, are we due for another big one? And some of it was to just keep public awareness up and make sure you had, you know, water stowed somewhere safe and all of the things that you need to do when you live on a quake zone. But also there was just this sort of notion of, we don't know. We don't know when it's going to happen. We don't have any particular, you know, skills in getting better at predicting when it's going to happen. And so we're going to try to sort of keep vigilant in the absence of anything better to do. Why is earthquake technology, prediction technology, such a challenge?
Well, it's a challenge because you don't know. This gets back to what I was saying earlier about the rock breaking. You just don't know when the stress is going to be big enough to make that rock slip in any one particular place. There are places actually in the San Andreas Fault that have talc, like baby powder, in the rock, which also can affect slipping. Something that subtle can go on. So it makes it extremely difficult to predict it. But what you saw when you were living in San Francisco was the knowledge that there is a potential for very large earthquakes. And in some ways, you can argue it's actually more important to ask yourself, are the buildings built to withstand the biggest earthquake we can expect, then can we predict it's going to happen a week from Tuesday? Because if the buildings are built strong enough, then it matters much less when the earthquake occurs. And so even though the timing prediction is not very good, the prediction of how strong an earthquake can be is actually arguably more important question. And that is better answered by seismologists than the timing question, obviously, which is a by and large, a big question mark.
We have an email from Tanya in Iowa who says, I've always heard one of the biggest fault lines is in the Midwest. Can you tell me more? I live in Iowa and thankfully haven't experienced an earthquake. I'm really happy just avoiding tornadoes every spring. And actually, Tanya, I think we have an answer for you from Scott in Paris, Tennessee. Scott, do you know the Midwest fault line that our emailer is talking about?
Yes, it's the New Madrid.
And the New Madrid Fault. And do you live near there in Tennessee?
Yes, it's West Tennessee. I live right on it's the Tennessee-Kentucky border in Paris.
And do you regularly feel tremors there?
Roughly once a year, I'll feel a little bump if I'm sitting in the house. I was wondering I know you can't predict when, but we're due for a big one, I understand.
Yeah, New Madrid is an unusual circumstance because it is not one of these plate boundaries I was talking about between the tectonic plates. And so it's a much murkier situation to understand. But there was a really big earthquake there. I've never figured out whether this was apocryphal or not, but they claimed that it rang church bells in Boston and the Mississippi River supposedly ran backward,
right? I've heard that legend too.
Yeah. So, and some of that's true. Some of it may not be true. The church bells, I think, is a little, it may be apocryphal. I think the river changing direction briefly might actually have some facts behind it. But that is much harder to understand because that is not a nice clean fault like the San Andreas Fault, which is between the Pacific plate and the North American plate, where you can really study how the strain is building up there. This is a fault zone that is a result of forces that are much more diffuse. And so I think it makes it much, much more difficult to predict when an earthquake would occur there.
We are talking about seismic prediction and earthquake activity with NPR's Richard Harris. You are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's take a call from Jan in Holland, Michigan. Jan, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks. You know, Florida had just had that cold spell for a week when the Haiti earthquake happened. You think any contraction of the earth from that had anything to do with it?
Interesting question. I think that I can just sort of by first principles say that the cold penetrating your skin in your house probably did not go very far into the ground, maybe a foot or two. And considering that this earthquake originated about six miles below the surface, I think that a cold spell seems to be a highly unlikely cause of it.
Let's hear from Karen in Sonoma, California. Karen, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, thank you. I live a couple hundred miles south of Humboldt County, and there was an earthquake several weeks ago, and there was a video that was captured of the time the earthquake hit, and 5 seconds before the earthquake hit, a dog got up and ran out of the room, and then the video shows everything shaking. I'm wondering what kind of science or research has been done with animals in regards to prediction, and I'll take my answer off the air.
That's a great question, and I must say that it's been so many years since I looked into that that I can't really reconstruct off the top of my head, but it, certainly there have been enough stories and studies of animal behavior that that people have been very intrigued about what kind of clues these animals might be picking up. I believe the Chinese tried for a while to use animals as earthquake predictors, and supposedly it worked really well for one earthquake and then failed miserably for other earthquakes, even more deadly earthquakes. So it's intriguing, but I think that sort of turning that into science is a real tough challenge.
NPR's science correspondent Richard Harris, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
NASA is just months away from ending its space shuttle program. The shuttles have been flying for nearly 30 years. And if you've ever had to clean out a house you've lived in for a long time, you can imagine how much stuff NASA has accumulated over those three decades. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports on how the agency is trying to make sure each piece of history finds a home.
About 4 years ago, when it became clear that the shuttle program would be ending in 2010, NASA started trying to figure out what parts of its huge inventory might be worth saving. Joel Kearns is the transition manager for space operations at NASA headquarters.
I was really surprised that that everyone had a different opinion of what was a valuable artifact and what wasn't.
He's an engineer, so he personally likes old computers.
So whenever I would see these on the list, I would look at that and say, oh, some museums are really going to want that. That looks like an artifact. Well, many other people looked at that and said, that is the most boring looking black box. I would never want anything like that in my local museum. But they came up with things that I never thought people would find value in.
Things like windows for the space shuttles. A museum could use one of those to make a cockpit display. So a precious artifact may be in the eye of the beholder. And Kern says there's a lot of decisions to be made.
The whole space shuttle program has about over a million line items of personal property that they have on their books. And that ranges from nuts and bolts and little pieces of computer parts all the way up to the space shuttle orbiters themselves.
NASA has three space shuttles. Space Shuttle Discovery has already been promised to the Smithsonian. So far, about 20 organizations have put in requests for a shuttle. The shuttle itself is free, but whoever gets one will be expected to cough up about $29 million to prepare and transport it. NASA should announce the lucky winners of Endeavour and Atlantis this spring. Meanwhile, NASA is putting other shuttle goodies up on a website so that educational institutions can browse through them. Places like museums, universities, and science centers. The public need not apply. Jerry Phillips works on the website for NASA. He showed me how you just log in, click on shuttle, and see a list of categories.
For instance, let's look at what we have available for clothing. Special purpose clothing. It shows that we have four items.
You can see a photo of dirty deerskin gloves that astronauts used in orbit. There's shorts and shirts. We click around and see items in other categories, like exercise equipment and shuttle parts.
Now, when you see this, you could actually, just like a eBay shopping experience, you could add this to a shopping cart and go through a full checkout procedure.
Unlike shopping at Amazon.com, a request does not guarantee getting an item. A special committee decides where each item will go. NASA's visitor centers and the Smithsonian get first dibs. About 900 items went up last October, and every single one had a taker. Today, the agency posted another 2,500 bits of history to the website.
This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Valerie Neal is a curator with the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum.
A program of this significance ends once a generation.
Neal says back when Apollo ended, NASA just boxed everything up and sent it to the Smithsonian. This time, the Smithsonian has to be more selective. It's planning to request only about 500 items. Curators have to decide now what historians and museum-goers will want to see decades into the future.
So we're really trying to play this mind game of figuring out for the long term? What's really important and why? And can we get it?
She showed me her wish list. It includes technical things, like a piece of orange insulating foam from the shuttle's fuel tank, things associated with famous space flyers, like Shannon Lucid, plus everyday things, like astronauts' favorite space food.
They love the shrimp cocktail. Why shrimp cocktail? We don't have shrimp cocktail in the collection yet, so I specifically would like to get a shrimp cocktail if they're not all eaten up.
Just last week, Neil was headed to Houston to look at a crew training module to see how it could be made into a museum display. She says it can be odd to size up equipment that's still in use. NASA workers usually have a couple of different reactions.
One, there's a kind of sense of regret that the shuttle program is coming to an end because people have been living it for 30 years. And then the other is that they say, these are artifacts. This is just stuff. You know, this is what we work with every day.
But if they're going to have to stop working with it every day, they're at least glad to know they'll be able to visit it in a museum. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
A basic question for the survival of any species, including humans, is how does the boy get the girl? Scientists know that competition among males is a big part of the answer. Still, as NPR's Joe Palco reports, even when the boy gets the girl, the competition doesn't end.
In the animal kingdom, males are always looking for a leg up against the competition.
Large antlers and coloration that allow males to obtain access to females.
That's Heidi Fisher, a biologist at Harvard University. Things like big antlers and bright colors help male animals get a female's attention. What Fisher is interested in is what happens next.
This is the point at which the animals have already made it, and there is still male-male competition.
It's just a different kind of competition. Here's what Fisher means. She studies mice. From a male mouse's point of view, after he's mated, the competition is over. It doesn't matter which of his sperm fertilizes the female's egg. But
from the sperm's perspective, of course, it wants to be the sperm within the whole sample to fertilize the egg.
So now it's the sperm that compete. One strategy for getting to the egg might be called every man for himself. Each sperm would go it alone and hope for the best. But Fisher and others have shown that a clump of sperm swimming together move faster than a single sperm swimming alone.
It's almost as if you don't cooperate, you'll be left behind, because only the cells that are cooperating are going to be able to reach the egg with a decent speed to have a chance at fertilizing the egg.
You still have to compete with other sperm in the clump when you reach the egg, but hey, at least you got there first. In her latest research, published in this week's Nature magazine, Fisher adds an interesting twist to the story. Female deer mice, it turns out, are promiscuous. They mate with several males when they go into heat. Fisher wondered whether the sperm would still take the approach of all for one and one for all, or whether sperm from one mouse would compete with sperm from another. So she took sperm from one male mouse and dyed it red.
And then sperm from another male, and we dyed it green.
Then she mixed the two sperm samples together, put them in a petri dish, and watched what happened.
And what we found more often than not is that red sperm tend to clump more so together, and green sperm tend to clump more so together.
Or to put it more colloquially, sperm of a feather flock together. Fisher doesn't know how sperm know who to buddy up with and who to snub. All she knows is that they do, and presumably it's all part of that drive to be the one to pass your genes on to the next generation. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Life is dull, it's nothing but one big lull, then presto, you do a skull. Find yourself reeling, she sighs and you're feeling like a toy on a string. And your heart goes ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding. How could that funny face seem to be commonplace? Project your ride into space without any warning. You don't know if it's morning, nighttime, winter, or spring. What's the difference? Ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding.